previously.tv podcast network.
You know, Abramson, I still think I should kill you.
Ah, that you, Willie? It's always a delight to see you, pal.
Yeah, you too, Goldilocks.
A former client threatened to kill me every day if I didn't win his trial. Got him a hung jury, he walked.
Willie doesn't sound grateful.
I'm not sorry. I did my job.
Is yet another take on the Menendez case worth investing in just because Dick Wolf and Carmela Soprano have given it their imprimatur? And should we blame Canada for not knowing a decorated member, of its military was guilty of rape, murder, and grand theft sex toy? Tara Ariano's back to talk about Law & Order True Crime, the Menendez murders, and the Russell Williams case. This is The Blotter Presents, episode 25. Welcome back, everyone. This is The Blotter Presents, where we talk about the best and worst of TV true crime. This week, we are discussing what the best of cop procedurals did with the worst, or at least most exhausted and picked over, of true crime as the long-awaited Law & Order take on the Menendez case premieres. I'm joined by the chung to my chung, Tara Ariano. Hello, T-Bone.
Hello.
Thank you for returning to talk about this Dick Wolf property. I didn't have to do a whole lot of arm twisting, but I'm interested to hear what you think as we take on this week's Most Wanted. Let us begin, as we always do, although I'm not sure we need to, with a case synopsis. There have been so many Menendez takes just in the last year for some reason that I seriously can't imagine. I have to review it, but just in case someone is listening to this on Rumspringa, here we go. Beverly Hills Richies Lyle and Eric Menendez killed their parents in 1989, immediately started spending their inheritance, and when finally busted for committing the murders, claimed that they were in self-defense because Jose had verbally and sexually abused them for years. Endless legal wrangling over the admissibility of evidence from Eric's shrink meant that the trial itself did not get underway until the early 90s. Both trials were broadcast wire-to-wire on Court TV, coverage that made that network, and had, thanks to the insanity surrounding the previous trial of the century, had not been permitted to that breadth since the trial of Bruno Hauptmann for the kidnapping of the Lindbergh baby. The brothers were tried separately, their initial juries both deadlocked. Juries in the second go-round were not buying the claims of sexual abuse. The brothers have been incarcerated since. Lyle is now on his second jailhouse marriage. Cool. Anyway, so sort of this is like the Dick Wolf version of American Crime Story, I guess. Tara, how into this case are you as opposed to other quote unquote famous cases?
I didn't really know anything about this case at all. It was sort of before my awareness of true crime, I guess. I mean, I was, when it happened, 89. So I was like 15. It was not right. Really my jam. And I probably wouldn't watch this one if not for the Law & Order branding, honestly. But, you know, the first two episodes were very grabby. They were definitely more to the criminal intent end of the spectrum, which is not a compliment. Okay. I have to say.
Okay. I wondered. Where you were going with that, but
Criminal Intent is the only one that I like never, ever, ever watch in syndication. Like I watched it for a while when it was on in first run, but you know, whatever.
It's tough to take. You know, I get it. It's just me out on that skinny limb with the Jeff Goldblum episodes. I understand.
Oh, I'm sure it's not just you. They're on all the time. Like people must be watching them. But what was interesting to me is that what makes this different from the rest of the Law and Order verse is that the defense lawyer is front and center, which is never, ever how it is. Like you're always on the side of the law and the order as opposed to the person who's trying to fuck with that on behalf of their clients. So that was interesting to me. I mean, I'm, and Edie Falco as Leslie Abramson is their defense lawyer is front and center in all of the marketing for this thing. And I'm sure, of course, partly that is because she's by far the most famous person in it, but also, and I sort of hinted at this with a tweet about my Pinko take on this was, I wonder how much of that is because of the different climate that it's coming to us in. And I will explain. You know, TV has more, because of how its production schedule goes, it can be more nimble in responding to, you know, real life current events stuff. And so I wonder if if that was a conscious decision to make a hero kind of, or at least it, so far in these first couple of episodes that we got to see screeners of the defense lawyer, as opposed to, you know, the people that are supposed to be on the side of justice, when in our reality, the people that are in charge of justice are like not doing a great job. The Department of Justice under Trump is, you know, declining to fight against bad gerrymandering cases. They're not defending, you know, they're not siding with the plaintiffs in voter fraud, or not voter fraud, obviously, in voter suppression cases. They're writing briefs in support of, you know, bigoted anti-gay Baker people. So I wonder if that's part of the thinking behind, you know, our audience isn't going to want to be on the side of the people that are trying to put them away. They want to be on the side of the person who understands how the justice system works and that it generally doesn't work for defendants, even when they're rich sometimes.
Yeah. I do wonder about that too, because we're immediately given a picture of Abramson as this maternal person, but who could also be like, I think it's sort of part genuine and part like not manipulation of her clients, but it's part branding. And I think we're not necessarily supposed to have concluded yet what those proportions are.
Right.
But we're definitely shown right away that she, first of all, has a lot of clients who have been abused and that she has used this defense before, but that she's also not unaware of the odds concerning, you know, murders in certain neighborhoods and within certain families. Let's actually hear clip 3.
Okay. There are no suspects yet. Family members offered their own theories.
My brother made the mistake of buying a business that had been used before by the mafia. When he took over...
What does a brain trust at the Times think?
Sobel and Johnson think there's something to this mob angle.
Their deaths leave behind two sons, Lyle and Eric Menendez. Yeah,
those boys did it.
Seen here attending their parents' memorials.
That's Chris Bauer, Dick Wolf, Dick Wolf Corps regular as... Leslie Abramson's husband. And it's interesting that the first we see of her interacting with this particular case is to say that they're guilty. But I think the current climate in terms of people who follow true crime, criminal justice, and so on, sort of on a real life basis, is that everything is in question based on what we now know about false confessions, corrupt police departments, juries just deciding based on race or from just not paying attention to the evidence as it's presented because they don't give a shit, that any conviction can be called into question and any defense has to be like really heard and not dismissed as ridiculous. And in this particular case, which is like these murders are almost 30 years old.
Yeah.
It's hard to give us any new information or to present a fresh take on it. And I think they're doing an excellent job of that, actually. Like, I'm pretty cynical about this case's ability to interest me at this point. And I'm going to keep watching this.
Yeah.
And then there's information I'm sorry, go ahead.
Go ahead.
There's information that I don't think I knew before, actually. Like this, well, let's listen to clip 4 quickly and then please return to your thought.
I found this tape recorder in your dad's study, wired to your line. There's tapes marked Eric and Lyle.
Did you know your parents were recording your calls?
Oh. I guess that's how Mom always knew what I was doing.
I don't know, Eric.
If it was me, I'd be pissed.
No disrespect, but your parents...
You don't understand, Henry. She was so unhappy. She was defenseless.
Okay. I'll bring the cassettes home.
I'd feel a few different ways about this clip. Most of them aren't good. Would you like to weigh in before I make my list?
Well, I didn't know it. I mean, I didn't know what was new information and what wasn't. So I defer.
I'm not sure that is new information, but I don't remember it. Like, I don't remember that they had like bugged their own sons.
Right.
This was weird exposition from the cousin that, there are a couple of times, and we'll hear this in another clip later, where I think the show is like trying to be like funny, or is like sort of winking at us a little. And I think that this is one of those times. So that was weird, but shall we talk about the actor portraying Eric Menendez and how we feel about the job he's doing? Because that was like more severe than usual, but there is a whole lot of like early Wentworth Miller happening in the line delivery, and I'm not sure it works for me.
Yeah, he's not great. I mean, he's saddled with the harder part in some ways. Like, he's obviously the one who's more fragile and identified with his mother and stuff, and the one who's been seeing a shrink because of other problems. But he, you know, he seems to have been cast because of physical resemblance more than anything else, I would guess, based on the quality of his performance. Like, he's fine.
Yeah. I mean, I have watched just about every possible Menendez property, and there will be a link in the show notes to dueling TV movies from the 90s that I reviewed for my original site, The Blotter.
5 years ago.
Yeah. And they were for like, you know, Beverly D'Angelo as Kitty. Like, you know, I've been on this beat a while, but that is usually a thankless role. But another thing that I am enjoying about this take on the case is that they're getting much more into the role of the shrink and his mistress. And these two, Josh Charles, oh my God, and Heather Graham in a like overacting wig off. I mean, it's kind of giving me life. Were you enjoying their scenes?
They're so campy. Like, they just are going for it. And I love it. They were my favorite thing about it too. Although I will say, with their wigs, both of them, given that an actual wig is like part of the story, like a wig that is a wig in the story, meaning Lyle's, like, it's funny that the wigs that aren't supposed to be wigs are so terrible.
They're so much worse. Like, Lyle's actual wig was bad. Lyle's wig in these reenactments is usually bad. Lyle's wig here is almost undetectable, and everyone else's hair is horrendo. But here's Exhibit A, as it were, of the mustard that Heather Graham is spreading on every like inch available of bread given to her. Clip 5.
I feel bad, Dr. Daddy. Make me better.
No thanks.
No one can help you, Judalon. What the hell kind of name is that anyway?
I mean, this name is, there was another sort of like equally baroque name that you heard in the news in a trial, like around the turn of the 80s in the tri-state area, Sucrete Gable.
No.
It was some like parking Queens scam and someone got killed. I mean, it's a lot, but like Judalon's name is all you heard for like a year while they wrangled over whether the tapes would come in of Eric's confession. And I think that that's an overlooked, interesting part of this case that they don't usually get into. And Josh Charles is very meme-ish, terrified groundhog acting is pretty good too.
Yeah, they're both having fun. I mean, the fact that they are their most recent credits before this are Wet Hot American Summer for him and Angie Tribeca for her tells you a lot. They have not really modified their attitudes that much for this, which is hilarious. Like, they are clearly in a very campy cul-de-sac, and I appreciate that they recognize that and are acting accordingly.
Well, at this point with this case, I think that a satire of The Thing is the same as The Thing.
Yeah.
Certainly for me, some of the reference that you and I associate with this case and 90210, we're beginning to muddy the waters somewhat. Clip six.
She asked me to pass on information. She said you should speak to one of Eric's classmates, a boy named Craig. They wrote a screenplay together.
I mean,
Wild Thing.
I totally forgot about that one. I actually left that in because they have clearly paid a lot of money for the, not that MC Hammer, I think, is charging all that much for Can't Touch This at this
point. Wasn't that Tone Loc? I thought that was...
That was Tone Loc, but there is MC Hammer in it later.
Oh, later, yeah, right.
They just wanted us to know they're serious about the music rights, but this clip definitely reminded me of the Brandon rescues Chandler, the aggro tennis star, from killing either himself or his dad.
Yep, in my notes I have total Roger Azarian shit. Uh-huh. Yeah, same thing.
Yep, tennis Roger.
A gorgeous Twin Peaksy blonde. Shut up. That's in season one, guys. Go back to our sister podcast again with this and seek it out. It is worth listening to.
Yes, that will also be in our show notes. Yeah, I do appreciate that this property is trying to do something different, but isn't taking itself or its subject too seriously. And that can be a really fine line with true crime, because people, like, unless you're talking about whatever, art forgery, which is like, not that no one cares, but no one died.
Right.
It can be a tricky tightrope to stay up on. But I do appreciate that they do seem to think that Lyle is a full of shit trifler, a la clip seven.
Wow, we've instructed you on this. You have to page this before you come down, so we can secure the area.
Look, I heard through this friend that everything's cool with the mob now, so I won't need you anymore. Thanks.
I mean, okay, sure, because that's how the mafia and, you know, personal security work. Totally.
Who has ever said, I heard everything's cool with the mop now? Like, yeah, we all remember those episodes of The Sopranos when, you know, things just sort of tailed off because everything was cool. Also, they're supposed to be at Princeton in that scene, and it's pretty clearly Pasadena. Like, I think I've been on that street before. It's, you know, I've never been to Princeton. You can speak to that better than I, but that did not look like New Jersey to me.
No. And when they're in Chuck's Spring Street Cafe, which still exists, still is open for business, there's like this rabbit warren of streets, like Nassau Street, which is the famous one right across from the university. There's like a warren of streets behind it. And that's where all the, like, quote unquote, good restaurants were, like the good diners where they would give you a fried egg for $2.
Mm-hmm.
That is still down there. And it's just a small, like, it's little. It's a mostly delivery business. So it's not this like light, airy, you know, Bel Air situation, but I was...
Oh yeah, no, that looked like a Barney's Beanery to me.
Yeah, but I was pleased to know that it was still there, although I am 100% sure that it still exists because of Lyle. Certainly, that's the only reason we darkened its doorstep back in the 90s when I was at Princeton, but
sure,
yeah, still there. Apparently, the wings are pretty good. Not sure how that whole mogul thing was supposed to work out. The next clip is annoying to me. I'm going to play it, and then I'm going to ask you if you agree that we do not need the subplot.
Les, is this how it's going to be with the new kid? You're going to be the absentee mom like you were with Lane?
Okay. First of all, the new kid is going to have two parents. Secondly, you knew what you were getting into when you married me. This is one of the things you were getting into. Okay. Thank you.
That thank you accompanies her handing him her purse, which is great. I'm of two minds about this. I don't give a shit about the adoption subplot. There's plenty of other things going on here that we don't need. At the same time, I appreciate that they immediately put that this is her attitude about it on Front Street from the get, and that she was like, no, we're not doing this. You knew what I was. Quit it. How do you feel about the, how do you feel about A, the adoption thing being a thread and B, this their handling of it in this scene.
I mean, I thought this was very perfunctory. This seemed to me like we have to include something about her home life or else people are going to assume she's a lesbian just because I don't, not that there's anything unfeminine about her. I just mean like, cause you know, people are stupid. And if you don't include someone's marriage, then you, people will assume there's something wrong with a woman if she hasn't landed a man or whatever. Mm-hmm. And
I mean, same complaint, different access. So yes.
Yeah. In terms of the adoption storyline, you're right. Like I wonder if this was something that was mandated in exchange for cooperation from someone that like, well, include this part too, because this was also going on and it's relevant to Leslie's, you know, her sort of mama bearishness with her clients,
sure.
Which is also what's happening in the scene. They're at the jail in the middle of the night. Why the husband came, by the way, I'm not sure.
Yeah, he's like, we have to be up in 5 hours. It's like, bitch, then what are you doing here?
Stay You're a reporter. Home. You're not it. Part of this. Like, she's what's happened is that she's been notified that one of her current client has been beaten up in jail, and so she's there to make sure he's okay. And then no one in the medical area or whatever it's called in the infirmary is helping him. So she demands a bowl of water and she cleans him up herself. Like that was more interesting to me. Like that tells us everything you need to know about this character, this person, than the whiny husband complaining in advance about the baby they don't have that she's neglecting. Like this is dumb.
Yeah. And
I mean, I get why it's there. I just wish it didn't have to be.
Yeah. And he always gets that. Like, this was his entire arc on Third Watch with Faith Yokas, as far as I can remember. Mm. So
lame.
Free Chris Bauer. But yeah, I also wonder if maybe this wasn't, if Falco didn't sign on with the understanding that she would be given some other stuff to play that wasn't all courtroom stuff.
Right. Maybe. Yeah.
She doesn't seem like that type, but I don't know. And doesn't she have an adopted child or two? So it's not like she can't.
I believe that's right.
Okay.
I think she does.
I mean, who knows? Who knows what went on behind the scenes? But yeah, I don't love that, but I liked that she was like, don't do this to me now. So
yeah,
that was good. And I think Falco's doing a great job. I've been seeing some shade about the wig on Twitter, but I mean, Abramson's hair really does look like it's actually a wig, so I'm okay with it.
Yeah, her hair is really bad. Her real perm is real bad.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, we have one more clip in this section, which you called for. Do you have any lead up before we have a listen?
No, this is after Eric's been seeing his shrink, Dr. Josh Charles. And now Lyle is getting involved because Eric has apparently confessed to the murders. And so they, you know, under the aegis of doctor patient confidentiality, they're getting into it, but not into all of it. Clip 9.
You didn't tell him, did you?
About that? No.
Okay. I'll figure something out.
So, you know the case better than I do. Are they talking about the abuse by their father or something else?
I mean, it's a little hard to say. This is always the problem with showing both sides of this case is that the script has to be a little cagey as to how much it believes in Lyle and Eric's innocence or in their, not in their innocence, but that this claim is true.
Right.
That they were abused. I mean, I think everyone's pretty in agreement that, you know, pretty much in agreement that Jose was a bastard, but to that extent, I'm not, you know, I don't know what the conventional wisdom is. I would not tend to believe it, but I also kind of think maybe it only happened to Eric or
right.
Like, I think there are things that we're just never going to know about that.
Right.
When I first pulled this clip, I assumed that not about that meant the murders, but I think now listening to it back, I think it has to mean the abuse.
Yeah.
But it's
because this is after they've talked about the murders.
Right.
They've had that conversation.
Yeah. No, it.
So
it
like the murder is the less shameful thing that they can't that they can talk about and that there's something worse.
Yeah. But that's that's always the thing that it's like.
Right.
You have to eventually you as a like author, basically, or, you know, narrator of this have to commit to what you believe happened. And tell the truth from that, otherwise you have, otherwise there's no point in having scenes between Eric and Lyle, criminal intent style.
Yeah.
So, mm-hmm. But I think they're splitting the difference pretty well with this miniseries. And I think like, I thought the time shifting and the flashbacks was going to be annoying, but they're doing pretty well with it. I think given how well trodden this ground is.
Yep. I agree. It's held my interest. It's not as it's not as prestige TV-y as American Crime Story, the OJ season from last year or the year before. God, when was it? Was it last year or the year before? No, it was last year.
I think it was early last year. So it's been almost 2 years ago, right?
Yeah. This is definitely the cable or the network TV version of that. There's stuff that they can't do and sometimes you feel it, but it's good. It's still good. Like Edie Falco's always good, including here.
Yeah, it's true. I mean, I wasn't particularly looking forward to this, frankly, because there are certain properties doing this podcast that you're like, well, I have to. And this particular case is like, there must just be something from it. Making of TV standpoint that makes it extremely attractive to showrunners, to producers, to actors. I don't know what that is exactly, but it must be something because there are no anniversaries happening in the case at the moment that are particularly significant. There's nothing new. It's not like either Menendez has either tried to escape or claimed that DNA evidence was incorrect. Like the case is in a whatever dead posture. So I would love to hear from like a range of producers who have worked on properties like this to see like, what is it? What is it about this case?
Well, I think there in the Law and Order, original Law and Order episode that's based loosely on this case, which is from, to give you an idea of how long ago this all happened, it's from season one of Law and Order. Like fucking Greavy is one of the detectives investigating it. Like that's how old it is.
Yeah.
But they have a line in there where it's like, you know, husbands kill wives. It's unusual for kids to kill parents. And I think that's part of it, that it's against the natural order of things.
Yeah, I guess. And there is a sort of like biblical top note to this. Yeah, I guess.
Right. And they were rich and, you know, there's the Latin husband, white, crazy wife aspect of it too. Like it has a bunch of things that you can chew on. And I didn't even know about the shrink stuff before, but like that alone is enough for it to get this kind of treatment. Cause that is so bananas.
Yeah. That's amazingly one of the many, many, many people who have portrayed Jerome Oziel is one of the shrinks who treated Mr. Monk in Monk and who was also Amanda Woodward's boss, Stanley Camel. That's right.
Right. Oh, Tony Marchette.
Tony Marchette Sr. Excuse me. The late Stanley Camel.
To bring it back to 90210.
All right. So you're going to keep watching this?
Yeah. Oh yeah. I'm in for sure.
Yeah. No, same with me.
So it's Tuesdays at 10 on NBC. 10
Yeah.
Eastern.
On actual NBC.
Yeah. And as this comes out, the first episode is just aired, but I'm sure you can see it on demand or on Hulu, or they'll probably run it again on like Friday or something because they've clearly spent a lot of money on this. Maybe not on the wigs.
Never enough on the wigs. All right. That is it for our most wanted section. And now for something completely different in the cold case section. We will be reviewing a program which I had never watched before called The Fifth Estate. This episode is called Russell Williams Above Suspicion. It is available on YouTube. You can find that in our show notes. Here is a case synopsis from the YouTube page and also Russell Williams's Wikipedia page. He piloted prime ministers and royalty and later commanded our country's largest Air Force base in Trenton, Ontario. Today, Colonel Russell Williams sits in a prison cell convicted of multiple charges, including two murders, sexual assaults. There were more sexual assaults than murders. This is bad writing. And dozens of break and enters. And then, from his Wikipedia page, subsequent to his conviction, his uniform was burned, his medals were destroyed, and his vehicle crushed and scrapped. Canadian Armed Forces do not fuck around when
that is
someone
so extra.
Goes rogue.
I mean, it's terrible. People died. I'm not laughing at that. But like,
really, really teenage girl of the Canadian Armed Forces to be like, and another thing.
Okay, well, okay. So two things. Play the first clip, play clip 10, and then I'll tell you why I called for it.
Okay.
But following his promotion in July 2009, according to police records, the frequency of the break-ins increased too. There were 10 more in his first 2 months as wing commander. And all the while, Colonel Williams performed his official duties, golfing with hockey great Johnny Bauer to raise money for military families, appearing at a charity drive to send gift boxes to soldiers abroad, cementing community relations, inviting local officials on a flight to the far north.
Number one is that's our host, Bob McEwen. His accent, if you've never, I just imagine Americans listening to this having no concept of what they're even hearing. Like, his accent is so chewy, even for a Canadian. Like, that is not typical. I looked him up to find out what his deal is, and I couldn't find a place of birth, but it's very maritime-y to me. He apparently grew up in Ottawa, and I learned in my researchings, before he became a journalist, he was a professional football player. He was in the CFL for 6 years.
Wow.
Yeah. Canada's
Go ahead.
Go ahead. I was just going to say he's Canada's Tiki Barber with all that that implies.
Okay. I was going to say he's Canada's Steve Crofts, I think, because the delivery that's like almost Shatner and the way everything sort of runs to the back of each word.
Yeah.
But I mean, it's fantastic, especially given some of the things that he's obliged to narrate in this story.
Yes. Well, we'll get to those. But the other reason that I called for that clip of like the enumeration of the things that Colonel Williams did in his office is like they're all so Canadian. Like, there's nothing about him doing anything in a war. It's all about like, you know, doing stuff in the community or flying people up to the, you know, into Nunavut or whatever. Like, putting together charity boxes, like, it's Canada. And on top of that, his second home is in a place called Cozy Cove. Like, if you couldn't write this, it's so absurd.
No, you really couldn't. I had never heard of this guy before. And the show is very, like, it's very good and professional at, like, packaging this story. Like, right up top, they show a picture of him in uniform, and then there's, like, a procession of increasing close-ups to show his, like, whatever, dead shark eyes or whatever we're supposed to think of him in this grainy photo. And I was like, mm-hmm, like, checking all the boxes there, Fifth Estate. But, have you watched other episodes of the show?
Yeah, it's a news magazine show. It's like a 60 Minutes or Dateline type of show from CBC, our national broadcaster.
So, yeah, he's like, you know, just doing his thing. But apparently, and then there's like a long interlude where his bestie from college talks about how they live together in residence. And Williams touched off this prank war where everyone would be hiding in each other's closets for like hours waiting to scare them.
Yeah.
And the guy's like, yeah, I guess he started that trend, but we were all doing it. I'm like, it's still weird Get a TV, Jesus Christ.
Yeah, he's not that old. It's not like this was before entertainment was invented. Like, he's, you know, in his 40s when all this stuff is happening.
Well, yeah, like, you're in university, find a book and read it. Stop sitting in each other's closets. And then he mentions this terrible breakup and, like, seems to imply that this breakup is, like, what sent Williams down the path of murderous creepiness.
Mm-hmm.
But yeah, he's continuing to commit these crimes, and then I believe, like, the circle is starting to close, but I think they thought it was his neighbor.
Yeah, let's hear clip 11.
Okay.
He says, "Who lived next door?" I said, "Russ Williams, commanding officer for CFB Trenton." And he says, "Well, I guess no sense looking at that guy then." Just like that, eh?
Tara, why on earth would you have called for this clip? I just don't understand.
Just like that, eh?
I mean, I feel like Canadian here at all.
It's important for me to be on this podcast. I mean, my accent is bad also from living in America for 10 years, and I've lived all over Canada as well. Like, it's not placeable, but everyone in Canada does not talk like this guy. We don't all say A. In fact, very few of us say A, but yes, that is the, like, such a Canadian clip.
It really, and I believe this gentleman was sitting in his home in an armchair with, like, an Afghan over the back. Like, it was just classic.
Of course. In Cozy Cove, where no one locks their doors.
And where one locks their doors.
I assume they do now. Well, I mean, yeah, so should we move on to the next clip, which really...
Well, would you like to take us through one of the other participants in this program and, like, what happened before this clip?
Yeah, this is Anne, right? That's her name?
Yes.
There was evidence that someone had rifled through her bedroom and some items were missing, and she thought someone was just playing a joke on her. But, like, before they get into what we're about to hear in the clip, that Bob McCune, our host, is like, you know, went into a drawer and what were missing were her dildos, as she calls them. Like, okay.
I'm pretty sure everyone calls dildos dildos, but okay.
Well, I thought maybe it was because, I mean, it will become clear when we hear the clip, but I thought it was because, like, maybe she's not a native English speaker, so she's, like, only knows one word for sex toys and, like, doesn't differentiate between a dildo and a vibrator, for example.
Yeah, that makes sense, because I think her partner were both, I mean, they had French Canadian last name, so I just assumed they were Quebecois originally, but I don't know.
Yeah, I mean, if they're, like, in the Ottawa area, that's close to the border. So there's a lot of native French speakers or francophones in that area too. They aren't necessarily from Quebec, but yeah. But yes, it turns out it was not a friend playing a prank on her. I love before we hear what actually happened to her, like, that she's so frank about it. Like, she doesn't care. Who knows? She doesn't mind going on national television and telling a government funded body that, yes, I have sex toys and I keep them. Who cares? But anyway, play code 12.
And they were stolen. And then apparently, like, they were trying to decide whether to call the cops. But it was like, what are the cops going to do? Because it's a bunch of dildos. Here's clip 12.
Oh my God.
It was the screen of an old computer that was rarely used. It had been turned on, the screensaver disabled, and replaced by a chilling message. In large letters, it said, "Go ahead, call the police. I want to show the judge your really big dildos."
Canadian journalism reaches a new height.
Honestly. Anyway. So these are the cute ones where all he's doing is breaking into people's houses and creeping them out. And the other creepy part of that, other than what we just heard, is that she figured out that he was in the house when she was there, which, ugh.
Yeah. And but, also had apparently, like, I sort of inferred, although maybe that was incorrect, that he had heard them talking about whether or not to call the authorities.
Oh, yeah. Good
and
point.
And then was like, yeah, why don't you do that? Also, I love that they include that he had disabled the screensaver. That it was like, I wouldn't even have thought about whether that happened, but okay. No flying toasters for you, only really big dildos.
Yeah. Well, here's where you have to stop laughing about it, because on from dildos to this is where he escalates to actual murder. And the sexual assaults that he committed were, of course, horrible also, where he would lurk in someone's house and then he would like tie them up and blindfold them and then photograph them for, it says, hours, which is horrifying.
And in one of these cases, at least there was a like 2 month old baby like next to them.
Yeah.
And yeah. But as they sometimes say on the old cop procedurals, sometimes the criminals just catch themselves once they finally got onto this guy's trail. Turns out maybe keeping trophies was not something Colonel Williams should have been doing in our final clip.
Search warrants obtained by police for Williams' homes in Tweed and Ottawa led to boxes and boxes of female apparel. Not just bras and panties, but bathing suits, robes, even shoes, as well as photographs of some of the young girls and women who owned them, all apparently painstakingly stored and cataloged in a notebook, recording when and where they were stolen.
I mean, like, maybe he did use a code and they just didn't say that, but use a code. Better yet, don't write it down. Better
now,
yet.
What do you fucking need a ledger for? Like for your tax returns? What is wrong with you?
I know. Oh, God, Jesus. Oh, yeah. And also, they said earlier that he would go through family albums and take photographs out of them of like women and young girls, usually in bathing suits. Like, ugh.
Yeah.
I mean, it's unfortunate that there are so many like risible details of this case, because this guy was a serious problem and this went on for a long time. Like, breaking and entering alone, they think it was like 80 houses that he broke into.
Yeah. When they show the maps and like it's all in an area, and like he didn't go far either. Like he obviously thought, you know, his stature as a military person would protect him. And evidently it did for a while. Like they weren't even going to talk to him, as we heard in that earlier clip. But
Well, and Anne also says at some point, like she lived in Belleville, I believe, which was like neighboring jurisdiction. And these are not big police forces that are necessarily used to, like, you know, convening a task force to stop the Cozy Cove panty stealer.
Yeah.
So I think that was an issue. Also, it was like just jurisdictional, you know, people were not sharing information, but it's not like it was the 70s and they would have to like telex it. You'd think they would have heard about it from someone else they knew in law enforcement. But in any case, when they caught him, he cracked almost immediately. So,
yeah, there's also an episode of The Fifth Estate, which I started to watch it and then I stopped because it's kind of boring. But if you're interested, they did a whole special that was all about his videotaped confession, where they have people sort of, you know, pop up video style, almost like commenting on how it's going and what the detective that's questioning him is eliciting information and stuff, but it was a little dry, but it's also on YouTube.
And we will link to that in the show notes.
I also just want to say, cause I did a side by side and I'm sure you will tweet it out this week from at Blotter Presents on Twitter or put it on Facebook or both. He looks exactly like that one character actor, Gregory Sporleader who's from The Rock. He was also the health inspector on Friends. He's got like a very pointy nose and like a jutting chin, and when you see them side by side, you will be amazed, especially since Sporleader, having been in The Rock, they are both in the side by side that I made in military garb, which also helps
point out the similarities. At first I was like, wait, so there was a TV movie about this guy? Like,
no.
I just assumed there should be now, because that guy
there
is
should.
Spot on.
Yes.
All right, Tara.
Yep.
Well, I regretted a little yesterday not having dragged in the catfishing case of East Tennessee from hashtag killer post the TV show, but maybe you'll consent to come back and talk about that the next time.
I would love to.
In the meantime, where else can listeners find you?
Well, I'm on Twitter at Tara Ariano, TaraArIano, and on Instagram if you like seeing a billion photos of my dogs. And you can also hear me as this drops my new podcast with Kevin O'Keefe called Will and Grace and Kevin and Tara is having its premiere episode tomorrow, Thursday, September 28th, right after the first episode of the Will and Grace reboot. We'll be going through episode by episode on the reboot and then starting from the very beginning of the original series with the 1998 pilot and going on episode by episode from there. So find us on Twitter at Will and Grace PTV, and you can find us on all of your favorite podcast apps right now.
Excellent. Thank you so much for joining us. Next time on The Blotter Presents, it will be Stephanie Early Green returning to talk about the disappearance of Maura Murray, which somehow has warranted yet another limited series. Is it worth watching? We will let you know. I'm Sarah D. Bunting. I'm your host. You can find me on Twitter at Tomato Nation. You can find the podcast on Twitter at Blotter Presents, and you can find us on Facebook at Blotter Presents. Thanks so much for listening, and we'll talk to you next time.
Been a production of the Previously.tv Podcast Network.